Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Monday, May 1st. Let the record reflect the time is 3:17 p.m. Today we have present Representative Sadler, Representative Prox, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. Today in committee we have four bills on the agenda. I'm going to start with House Bill 21. Then we're going to do House Bill 126 from Representative Wright. Then we'll hear House Bill 97 from Representative Prox. And we'll finish the meeting hearing from House Representative Armstrong on her House Bill 100. Starting with House Bill 21, Representative Wright, what is the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move HB 21, also referred to as 33L50254/alpha, be advanced from committee as amended with recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Object.
Okay, there is objection. Representative Carrick, I'd like to speak to your objection.
So to the chair, and I believe that House Bill 21 presents the potential for a great number of unintended financial consequences. We had talked about the utility of an actuarial analysis, and I believe that's something that the committee could request and get back, just not in a quick fashion. I think if we are doing our due diligence on this legislation in this committee, that would be something that we should do in order to thoroughly vet the legislation. So I'm going to maintain my objection.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Certainly understandable. Representative Fields. Representative Sadler.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fields.
I'll vote against it if we proceed as is, but I might suggest that we consider withdrawing the motion, asking the department to get us that actuarial analysis.
Thank you.
Take a look back and see were there any amendments that we want to consider and then readdress it. 2 weeks left. I would be shocked if this bill gets heard by the next committee, and I think that we're really the committee of jurisdiction. We should vet it. I think a bill of this structure could accomplish the stated purpose with proper vetting and development, and we just need to make sure that the groups that are coming on are not adding to the state's cost burden. It is definitely not inevitable that larger groups will save the state money. They can under certain conditions, and I think we can actually make sure that they do under certain conditions. It's a little hard to make that judgment without the analysis. So I guess I'd first suggest that we actually not just straight up vote on it, because I think we could get to a point that I would certainly want to vote for it after seeing the analysis and considering amendments. But if we move forward today, I'll just vote against it because I think that there is a significant risk of unintended consequences, and there's not another committee that's really has the capacity to vet it in the way that we do. So I don't like the notion that we defer the actuarial analysis to finance, but then leave them actually all the policy decisions where they're really not the experts on insurance policy decisions.
Well considered, Representative Fields. Thank you for your comments. Representative Sadler.
No, thank you.
Okay, there is objection. Please call the roll.
Representative Prox.
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Representative Fields.
No.
Chair Sumner.
Yes. And so with 5 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 21 has been advanced from committee. We will take a brief recess. Okay, we're back on the record. We're going to move on to House Bill 126. Representative Wright, please approach the committee. Put your name on the record.
Spell it, please.
Representative Wright.
For the record, I'm Representative Stanley Wright, House District 22. Thank you, members of Labor and Commerce, for hearing HB 126 once again. With me, I have my staff.
To the record, my name is Rachel Gunn, staff to Representative Wright.
Okay. You want to do a brief recap, Representative Wright, or any final words?
Absolutely. Ms. Gunn will go through a very brief recap.
So this bill, basically what we're doing is we're introducing a tiered licensors for professional counselors. So this fills the gap between when people have their postgraduate education completed and they need to work on their 3,000 hours, allows them to do so under supervision of the Board of Professional Counselors by creating this associate counselor designation. It's got a zero fiscal note because it will be paid for by receipt services, the licensing fees, and hopefully we'll see it speed up the licensing across the board for this profession.
Okay. Well, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Just through the record, through the chair, to Ms. Gunn, possibly, just want to confirm that will associate counselors have their services reimbursable under Medicaid or under private health insurance?
No. Through the chair, for the record, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Ruffridge, what is the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill 126, version A, also referred to as 33-LS0405/S, be advanced from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay, without objection, House Bill 126 has been moved from committee. We will take a brief at ease while we sign the recommendation sheet. Moving on to House Bill 97 from Representative Prox, received a committee substitute for this bill from the sponsor, and we will adopt it now as the working bill. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I move the committee substitute for House Bill 97, work order number 33-LS0392/S, be adopted as our working document.
Okay, without objection, the committee substitute has been adopted as our working document. Do any members of the committee have questions for the sponsor? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'd appreciate the sponsor could walk through changes between the original version and the CS we just adopted.
Thank you, Representative Mike Prox, District 33. Through the chair, the change is on page 2, lines 19 and 20 were added. A second requirement that the unit renter requires the unit renter to disclose any lien holders with an interest in property that will be stored in the storage unit. And the purpose of that was just to make it easier if somebody is storing a car or a four-wheeler or a boat or whatever, so that the unit owner knows that they need to notify a lien holder before the foreclosure process is completed.
Then, the chair, that's the only change? Is that the only change?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Fields?
Mr. Chairman, I was just looking and don't have the cell phone number anymore for R. Davidson, the owner of Best Storage, which I think is the largest self-storage business owner in my district and one of the larger ones in Anchorage. So through the chair, I was just curious if Representative Prox had heard from him on his perspective on this. I would just be interested as a someone who represents a lot of businesses in my district he owns. Thanks.
Through the chair, I have not.
Through the chair, I used to have his number. I don't. If I'd just like to hear from him for a business perspective. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will be setting this bill aside for Wednesday, where we've noticed the amendment deadline at noon, and we can discuss any potential amendments, and perhaps if somebody would like to reach out, maybe we can have him on for questions. And so, seeing no other questions, we will set this bill aside for Wednesday. Like I said, we had already noticed the amendment deadline for Wednesday at noon, so we will then address amendments.
Right.
Thank you, Representative Prox. And then last on the agenda, we have House Bill 100 from Representative Armstrong. Please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Sumner. Thank you, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Jenny Armstrong, and I represent House District 16.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong.
The bill we are discussing today, HB 100, would provide 18 weeks of paid family and medical leave to state employees and teachers. And in a forthcoming committee substitute, we will be standing up an insurance framework that would provide the private sector an option to opt into this, which we will get into. So first, I want to focus on the problem that we have before us in Alaska and that I know is top of mind for many of us here, which is the fact that families are struggling and our workforce is barely hanging on. Alaska is already a cost-prohibitive place to raise a family, and if you throw in the added difficulties of finding childcare and not having any paid leave, it makes it that much harder to look around and see Alaska as a place where you want to stay or come to if you want to have a family. Couple this with Alaska being a place with high incidence of infant and maternal mortality, and you can see that we have a lot of room for improvement and an opportunity to support our families. And of course, this impacts our workforce with recruitment and retention issues ubiquitous in Alaska, especially in state government and among teachers. Anything that can ease that crunch is valuable. So 23% of moms in the United States return to work within 10 days of giving birth, and it is almost always due to the fact that they cannot afford to stay home. Contrast this with the fact that in 28 states, there are laws or regulations that govern how old a puppy must be before they can be sold or rehomed. And of those states with these laws, all but three of them state that a puppy must be 8 weeks old before it can be separated from its mom. The reason for this is because it is cognitively and developmentally damaging for the dog to be separated from its mom, yet we offer zero paid leave or similar options in most states and expect babies to be separated from their parents for 8 hours a day from day one after giving birth. So we have an opportunity to fix this, and that first step is to invest in our families. We know from decades of research that investment in early childhood development from before birth through preschool, each dollar spent has an exponential return on that child's eventual success in society. Professor James Heckman is well known in early childhood research, and his efforts demonstrate that the more investment a community makes in a child's early social and emotional well-being, the higher outcomes can be correlated with higher life, with later life. Generally, these are cited as anywhere between 13 and 16x return on investment for every dollar spent. It is calculated by the likelihood that the child performs well in school, has a lower likelihood for ACEs scores, is less likely to commit violent crime, and has a reduced chance of drug use or addiction. The Heckman curve is not just based in economics. It rests in large part in our biological development. Early cognitive development is known to be linked to better problem solving, motivation, focus, social and economical, emotional skills, and more. The more stimulation a child has with their parent, the better their brain development. Positive, stable, and nurturing relationships in the early weeks and months are crucial to these neurological connections. Studies of infant brain activity show that higher stress levels in mothers correlate with decreases in critical brain activity that should be improving as a child matures. In other words, economic and societal stresses on parents can be impediments to brain development with infants at critical moments, compounding throughout the course of a child's life. So, how do we help make sure that these connections are made? How do we make sure that parents have time to bond with their children and foster that development and that they aren't penalized for having a child? The answer is creating the opportunity for parents to stay home with their children during the most crucial period of development. The U.S. is the only high-income country that does not have paid maternity leave. The U.S. and Suriname are the only countries in the Western Hemisphere that do not offer paid leave for either parent, and that leaves it up to the states to fill the vacuum. In the U.S., only around 12 states offer some sort of paid family leave benefit to workers and families, and in the array of interwoven challenges that families, businesses, and society face, paid family leave is a solution that is readily available and easy for all of us here to understand. It can remove enormous stressors from families, namely that of being able to afford food, housing, and medical care during the most important time for a family. So this map shows the states that have implemented paid family leave through a variety of different mechanisms. Some of them do it through payroll taxes and premiums. Other states offer these only to state workers and employees, and others have mandates for all employers to offer these benefits. Paid family leave creates healthier families, helps small businesses thrive, and increases recruitment and retention of workers. So I think, as we all know, the governor launched his Healthy Families Initiative early this year, and this bill is in perfect alignment with the goals that he laid out there. We've heard about the problems with recruitment and retention across the state with 10 straight years of out-migration and losing our working age population. This one benefit can single-handedly make a huge difference in reversing these trends. Paid family leave is a proven, powerful benefit that positively impacts families, businesses, and economies. And there is an overwhelming amount of data on paid family leave, and I am about to quickly hit on a lot of my favorite points for each subject area. All right, so it supports families because moms who get paid family leave are less likely to rely on public assistance. They can maintain their pre-leave wage level, which means that they can raise their long-term earnings and the amount they're able to spend in a state. We can reduce the likelihood that families file for bankruptcy due to a medical event. And reducing these issues can reduce toxic stress and the contributing factors to ACEs scores. And I think our state either has the highest or close to the highest ACEs score. So anything we can do to move our rank there is valuable. It supports infants because they are more likely to get follow-up appointments, checkups, and primary care. And this is probably, this next one is one of the most shocking statistics to me, is that paid leave is directly tied to a reduction in child mortality. Studies have shown that 10 weeks of paid family leave reduces neonatal and infant mortality by 10% and the mortality rate of children younger than 5 by 9%. As I've mentioned, it's positively associated with infant brain development and increased breastfeeding for infants, which has many health benefits for both mom and baby. Women who take paid leave have a 51% reduction in the odds of being rehospitalized. And if you'll permit me for a second, I'll stop through all my bullet points and just tell a story. So I had my baby 22 months ago, and I'm bringing this up, and one of the reasons this matters so much to me is I think I'm the only mom in the legislature with an infant or a toddler. And I was very, very lucky to be able to stay home. I had about 3 months of full-time paid leave and another month where I went back in slowly. I had a picture-perfect pregnancy, and as everyone knows, pregnancies are completely unpredictable. I had severe complications. I almost died. I was hospitalized for a period of time. I would have had no way to have predicted that. And if I didn't have paid leave, I could have lost my job. And it's something I'd always thought about, and at different points, I remember waking up on day 7, day 10, day 30, and thinking, how could I go back to work? I could not imagine how detrimental those effects would have been to me, to my health. I certainly don't think I'd be here, to my baby, to my family. And unfortunately, that is what is happening in our state. I am one of the very lucky ones that was able to take that paid leave, but it just feels so visceral and personal to me because I think of so many women who have zero leave and they're getting hospitalized and they're losing their jobs because there is no more paid time for them. They're going into debt or they're going back to work and, you know, fresh out of the hospital, baby in the NICU, whatever it may be, they don't have that space to heal and to bond, which is so crucial. All right, back to regularly scheduled programming. For parents, it reduces stress. Moms are less likely to report postpartum depression, reduce maternal health disparities, which is a really big issue in our state, especially with Alaskan Native mothers. And then another stat that I love, and I have to find where we got this. I think it's in your packet. Fathers who take paid leave are more likely to live longer. All right, so surveys, there's been a lot of surveys done in the states that have implemented paid leave and a lot of research to understand how is this impacting businesses? Is it having a negative impact that we now have people who are taking paid leave? And in California, following the implementation of their paid family leave laws, it shows that a majority of businesses said the program was positive or neutral on their business. The vast majority indicated that there were no zero cost increases because of this policy, with some even indicating that they had saved money by reducing benefit costs. Two-thirds of those said they adjusted the leave program simply by temporarily assigning work to accommodate the absence of coworkers. So going back up to the slide, you can see that in California, small businesses saw a 14% decrease in per-worker labor costs, and the smallest businesses have the greatest percentage-based savings. And workers who have access to paid family leave are, of course, more likely to return to work than drop out of the labor pool. So this goes beyond supporting families with newborns. If you have an adult or another dependent in your care in your home, we already have, as I mentioned, an unpaid policy, and we let workers take time off for a, quote, serious health condition, but this would, of course, allow for that paid time off. And there's a lot of stats here about how many, you know, households provide care for an adult loved one. Something that I think is really germane is that 71% of Alaskan nursing homes have a shortage of direct care workers. And so by being able to take that paid leave and not put your loved one in a facility, but stay at home and care for them in the home can make a huge impact on their outcomes, their burden on the state in the future, and so on. So most working people in the U.S. do not have paid family leave, and that includes 75% of Alaskans, which equates to about 270,000 workers in our state. If women in Alaska participated in the labor force at the same rate as women in countries with paid leave, there would be an estimated 8,000 additional workers in the state and 313 8 million more wages earned statewide, and women make up about half of our workforce. All right, friends, I tried to talk fast and teach deep there. Just to recap here, HB 100, we currently provide for 18 weeks of unpaid family leave to qualified employees. We're cutting the un and making it paid leave for state employees and teachers with 100% wage replacement. And then in our next hearing, which we're really excited to dig into, is it's based off of the New Hampshire model, which we can talk about a little bit today. But we want to create an insurance framework that would provide paid family leave benefits at no cost to state employees through a competitively bid insurance policy. And then other subdivisions of the state, like school districts, corporations, municipalities, would be able to opt in if they wanted to. And then the RFP would also allow for private businesses to purchase or opt into this plan at the same rate. These insurance products are already readily available, and they are treated under short and long-term disability policies in other states. These premiums are very affordable, often offered as supplemental coverage. Employers can choose to offer the plan to their employees at no cost through a payroll deduction, and individuals who employer opts not to have the policy would still have the right to purchase their own policy through the provider. So just in wrap up, we have a huge opportunity here to create a win-win for our state, our economy, our private sector, and our public employees and teachers. And with that, happy to answer any questions y'all have.
Any questions? Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. I've heard that many people are not having kids because they can't find care. What is the documented relationship between availability of paid family leave and people having as many kids as they would like to have if there was some mechanism to care for them? Thank you.
For the record, through the chair, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. Through the chair, Representative Fields, we can get this information for the committee, but as this body's heard in prior testimony, the cost of infant care for child care can be prohibitively expensive in a very, very tight market. And so the mechanism here is, in part, this would help provide opportunities for the parents to provide that bonding. And then also, it helps reduce costs down the line when they're able to reenter the workforce, where they're able to do so at roughly equivalent the same wage. And so that is one way that this will help address that cost. And the cost of having a child, we can get that information to the committee. Generally speaking, when we look at medical bankruptcies in the United States, if you have a complication from a pregnancy, those can run easily into the hundreds of thousands or even higher in terms of medical bills. And so those are all contributing factors to folks' decisions.
And Representative Fields, through the chair, off the top of my head, I think the cost for infant care in Alaska averages $17,000 a year, but that's if you can find it. It is the least, it's the hardest child care to find with the fewest spots in our state. And so I've certainly heard just anecdotally that that is an incredible barrier for people who even, first, if you can afford it, and then can you even find a spot, it makes it impossible. And so by having paid family leave, a lot of child care centers will start caring for kids starting at 3 or 4 months, and so you can know that you can stay home, and then you have a much better chance of finding child care after your paid leave ends.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, let's see, you mentioned that it was no cost to the employee, and then on the other hand, there was a deductible payroll deduction. Is this as far as the state is concerned, is that the state would be paying for the insurance policy and not added on to the, or deducted rather from the employee's paycheck? Is that the point of this?
For the record, through the chair, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong, through the chair, Representative Prox, the way New Hampshire has created it is that their particular model is kind of one of a kind in the country in that it's required for the state to offer it at state employees. They'll work through a competitively bid provider. In this case, it's MetLife. And they will provide that benefit to the state, or excuse me, to the employee, and they'll pay for the employee's premium. And I can get back to the committee with the question regarding the deductible. But generally speaking, in the New Hampshire bill, they capped the premium for individuals at a price that's roughly analogous to short and long-term disability premiums, which come out to, in New Hampshire's bill, $5 a week. I did my own calculation as a 36-year-old state employee, and if I were to apply on the currently available supplemental policy for the state, it came out to about $8.80 a week.
Well, and for the, let's see, for the current disability, or I guess it would be disability policy, I am not actually remembering what the exact policy was, but quite often there is a 30-day deductible, and then the policy kicks in. But that is for generally sickness or injury or something, and not this situation. And is that the same model that you're trying to follow with New Hampshire?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. Through the chair, Representative Prox, I think the short answer is yes. Many of these policies do have waiting periods, and employees here under this version of the bill and the community substitute we're working on, there would still be the same requirements for eligibility, and there would also be likely a waiting period. And so those are both factors that insurance companies use for these particular sorts of policies. So, yes.
And is this for just childbirth, or is it for other reasons that someone might need to take care of a family member?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong, through the chair, Representative Prox. Currently, version A of the bill on page 2, they delineate on lines 12 through 19 that this leave could be taken for pregnancy and the birth of a child, with the employee, a replacement of a child, other than the employee's stepchild, with the employee for adoption, the department, or any senior required employee's family leave on its paragraph, take a single block, and then they also include caring for a child, spouse, or parent with a serious health condition, or the employee's own serious health condition. And that is language that is currently existing in statute, however, it is simply unpaid.
Finally, through the chair, are you planning on getting some sort of an actuarial estimate from the administration, I guess? The fiscal notes appear to just include the administrative costs, but not the actuarial costs to the state. Are you planning to make that available?
Representative Prox, through the chair, we did an estimate through legislative finance, and we were going to submit this with the committee substitute when we bring that forward. I have it with me now, and I can walk you through it. For 18 weeks estimated, and you'll have a whole letter that explains how they came up with this modeling. 18 weeks for state employees would be roughly $15 million a year. And then the rough cost estimate for parental leave for teachers, if you assumed year-round eligibility, it could come out to around $7.7 million. If you only assume during the school year, $5.98 million. And those numbers are for 18 weeks of paid leave, and we will provide the modeling that was done for 6, 12, and 18 weeks across those three categories.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong, we can also make sure that Ledge Finance is available to speak to the modeling they've done.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Armstrong, who ultimately will pay the cost of providing state workers what amounts to, in certain cases, 100% of their annual salary for working 65% of the year? Because 18 weeks out of 52 weeks is about 35%, so leaving 65%. Where is that cost ultimately paid?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, it's paid for just like any other benefit. For us, and what we've seen in our research is that we are often losing these employees or they're not coming back and dropping out of the workforce. And so, yes.
Through the chair, so where is that? Where does that money come from?
The general fund.
The general fund. Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Through the chair, does DOA track how many people quit or don't accept jobs because of the lack of paid leave? I mean, I've certainly run into people anecdotally, but I don't know if that is tracked.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. Through the chair, Representative Fields, we had actually initially reached out to the Department of Administration when we were looking at this bill and the various policies other states have. In the state of Alaska, the Department of Administration actually doesn't track the use of unpaid leave for staff or state employees because it's treated under their personnel file. And so when we reached out to the department, they were unable to really provide any sort of like rough set of figures. And so what Ledge Finance did was work on modeling the birth rate towards the state employee pool as much as they could.
Through the chair, I'm also curious if departments would sort of level with us on offering de facto paid leave. I'm sure they do it to retain employees they want to retain. And I'm curious if they would tell us how frequently that occurs, because by my math, it's cheaper to keep someone than to do the replacement cost if you assume the replacement cost is about a half your salary, which it usually is. So I'm sure this is happening. I would be curious if they would tell us how much.
For the record, through the chair, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. Through the chair, Representative Field, I will get this answer to the committee. We'd found in the background research, and I thought it'd been in our slide or at least our script, but the average cost of the vacancy factor when it comes to recruiting and retaining employees comes out to about 21% of that employee's salary at least.
Representative Kerr.
Thank you, through the chair. And I just want to first thank Representative Armstrong for bringing this bill forward. I'm the only woman on this committee, and I just want to say that the decision to have children, for particularly for working mothers, is an incredibly difficult one. And so thank you for telling us about your personal experience as well. And the cost to the state may be high, and it may come from the general fund, but I think the data shows very clearly that the benefits are astronomically higher, not just in a social and health capacity, but also in terms of continuing to retain state employees and avoiding those vacancies. I have an unrelated question, which is, not being extremely familiar with paid family leave policy, in Section 3 of the bill on page 2, we talk about the work requirements, and I'm just curious, in Section B, that 35 hours a week for 6 months or 17 and a half hours a week for 12 months, is that a pretty standard, that language was already in statute for unpaid leave. Is that a fairly, from your interest in other states looking there, a fairly reasonable requirement in terms of how much work a worker has to be doing in order to qualify for paid leave?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff, Representative Armstrong, through the chair, Representative Carrick, the short answer is yes. Varying states do have a little bit more nuance. Again, some do it through outright mandates, and others, such as New Hampshire, are doing their models through voluntary benefits for private employers. And so we found that this period was relatively standard. Some are a little bit more shorter, but the state of Alaska is likely roughly in the middle of the pack.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, is this contemplated to be an optional benefit, or is it just a benefit that's included in the employee package? Is that what I'm thinking, that it would be something that is more attractive, for instance, to younger workers than older workers?
For the record, through the chair, Tristan Walsh, staff, Representative Armstrong, through the chair, Representative Prox, presently this is not an optional benefit as the bill is written. We also anticipated that as we look at the number of employees who would be taking this up, we, you know, went through some of the modeling with legislative finance, and that, you know, there's only so many employees who will be working to start a family or contemplating starting a family, and then simultaneously older workers might also be looking at things like some of these serious health conditions or serious health conditions for their spouse or their partners. And so we figured it was good to use that as a starting point.
Did I forget what I was going to ask? No. Through the chair. Have you talked to the employee labor unions, the representatives, and explored the option? This almost sounds like something that you would negotiate through the labor agreement rather than stipulating it through statute. So have you talked to the employee unions?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong, through the chair, Representative Prox, we did have a brief discussion with the NEA, and they only have one member district that currently offers this sort of policy. And so as president, we'd only really had pretty limited discussions with those various organizations.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wright.
Through the chair, thank you, Chair. So I see that you had the director of Doppler to prepare this fiscal note. Did you have any conversation with her on her thoughts on it?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. Chair Representative Wright, can you repeat which fiscal note you're referring to?
The one from Ms. Director Sheehan.
Oh. Presently, we started, through the chair, Representative Wright, we had very limited discussions with the administration at this point, but we know that there had been some interest from the administration given the overall policies of the administration this session.
Just a follow up.
Go ahead.
Just a quick suggestion. Maybe you should have a conversation with her. She does the labor relation negotiation, and she'd be able to help you out and guide you in the right direction.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Armstrong, have you any information as to what the current usage rate is of the current unpaid family leave in state employees?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that was one of our initial reasons to reach out to the department, but because they treat it under an employee's personnel file, it is not something that is centrally reported on or collected.
Okay. I was going to follow up and ask through the chair, anyone can answer, how much of the family leave is for childbirth and caring for a new child versus for a sick or injured or dying family member? Because FMLA covers a lot of different things, not just childbirth.
For the record, to the chair, for the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Armstrong, through the chair, Representative Sadler, we can endeavor to collect that, but I think that it might be that the department has its hands tied, given that information isn't currently collected.
Is there follow-up? Is there any national information? I understand that the family... there's national federal laws about Family Medical Leave Act. Did you look to see if there's any federal information?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff, Representative Armstrong, through the chair, Representative Sadler, we can get that to the committee, certainly.
And I've been taught to ask, when could you get that to us?
Within a week, sir.
In a week?
Within a week.
Thank you.
Representative Fields?
Through the chair, well, I was actually going to ask that question. I'm definitely curious about that, but also suggest that we ask ASEA. For the same information, I'm kind of curious what percentage of their members they anticipate would be using the family leave to take care of an elderly family member or someone who's sick versus parental leave.
Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Armstrong and staff. Seeing no other questions, we will set this bill aside for a future date. That concludes our business today. So that this is before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:02 p.m.